Hello, I'm Tony Whitehill, and this is number 0460 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0460. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Michael McCrae, who is the author of Acorn 8, Race, Power, and Politics, Memoirs of an Acorn Whistleblower.
Whistleblowing, especially in America, is a time-honored tradition that's really associated with the First Amendment of our Constitution. And so, if you think about it, there can be no free press without news sources. There's no congressional oversight without government informants. I tell people that whistleblowers are the fifth estate that protect our freedom and liberty.
Clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber is back on the show, this time to talk about non-competitive school sports.
The non-competitive sports is a crazy thing. I mean, I totally understand the idea. You know, you don't want kids to hold grudges against other kids and things like that. But one of the things that we found out here doing the research is when you do this, kids understand that the team that gets more goals is actually the winner. So what happens, they do that at a little age, 5 or 6 years old, they understand this. So when an adult, a teacher, says that nobody won and everybody gets the same trophy, the first thing you're teaching these kids is that adults lie and you can't trust them.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and on Book Banter, we follow Montreal writer Bram Eisenthal's almost lifelong search for meaningful employment with Hire Me If You Can. So get your resume ready for that next job interview. It's coming up soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0460, was Tony Whitehall, the morning announcer who also does the noon news and is the sports play-by-play guy at WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, one of the homes of the Stuff File program. Thank you very much, Tony, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the program, a show that is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? As you know, there is widespread concern and controversy in the United States about gun control. So the statement that was spewed out by a certain school spokesperson speaks volumes about the knee-jerk reaction that some display. Here's the statement. Appropriate steps were taken at the school level to ensure the safety of all students and to impress upon the students the seriousness of engaging in positive peer interactions while avoiding conduct that may pose risk or concern to others. That gobbledygook came flying out of the mouth of Will Clark, the chief operating officer of the New Haven, Connecticut Public Schools, about an incident at the Jepson Magnet School. Will goes on to say, school leaders and local police partners were able to investigate and resolve the issue internally with the use of restorative practices. What the heck does that mean? Anyway, that's pretty much all the school officials wanted to say about the incident. What incident, you ask? Well, the school felt it was necessary to call the police because a child built a toy gun out of Lego blocks and pointed it at others. Let me repeat that. A child built a toy gun out of Lego blocks and pointed it at others, and the school called the police. Oh, dear Lord. I'm guessing the school decided to err on the side of caution, you know, before the kid built Lego bullets. Anyway, a quote from Marsha Wetzel of Chicago starts off with, I felt like a person in a pool of piranhas. Meanwhile, Administrator Betsy Gran of San Francisco concurred in her statement when she said, there's the clique system just like everywhere else. They and others are told they can't join people at cafeteria tables. They've seen fistfights break out, bullying is rampant, and dances are breeding grounds for gossip and cruelty. Now, you'd think we're talking about high school here, but oh no, we're talking about senior centers where they live, in the case of Marcia, who is 70, or work, in the case of Betsy, who is in San Francisco. It's like Mean Girls, Betsy says, but everyone is 80. The Institute on Aging has developed an anti-bullying program to help. Yeah, it's like high school, except in this case, notice how no one is asking, where are the parents? Yeah. Meanwhile, how weird have elections in the U.S. become? Well, let's take a look at one race in South Dakota. A South Dakota sheriff waited a whole minute after polls closed to fire a deputy who undid his re-election bid last week. Bonhomme County Sheriff Lenny Gramko fired Deputy Sheriff Mark Maggs after Maggs defeated him in a Republican primary election. Maggs posted his time-stamped termination notice signed by Gramko on Facebook after polls closed. Gramko didn't give a reason for the firing. South Dakota is an employment-at-will state where employees can be fired without cause, with exceptions. The sheriffs also have the authority to hire and fire personnel. Gramko declined to comment about the firing. No other candidates filed for the race, meaning that Maggs will assume office in January. But for now, the father of four is out of work. He plans to meet with the county commission. Some residents started an online petition to have Maggs reinstated as deputy sheriff, but he said it's unnecessary. I trust our county commissioners heard your voices on Tuesday night through the election results, and I also trust that they will stand with my family and I in the way you all have and ensured that my family will not be left hanging without an income or insurance, Maggs said. Gee, outgoing Sheriff Gramko had better be wondering what he's going to do for employment in the new year. I mean, his constituents wanted him out, and I'm guessing his poor loser attitude isn't going to win him rave reviews during his future job hunt. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here's another story that starts off with a quote. It's the combination of a sweet, slightly musky, vanilla-like fragrance with slight overtones of cherry and the natural smell of a salted wheat-based dough. You'd think that's a quote about a sweetbread recipe, right? Nope. The scent of Play-Doh compound has always been synonymous with childhood and fun, continues Jonathan Berkowitz, the molding compound's senior vice president of marketing at Hasbro. So Hasbro applied for, and the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has granted, a registered trademark on the way Play-Doh smells. Originally created in the 1930s to clean coal dust from wallpaper, the goo hit it big by adding coloring and appealing to children. Hasbro bought the brand in 1991. So, Hasbro's lawyers will now get busy sending cease and desist letters to every bakery in the country. Well, that'll be the yeast of their problems. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Roughly half of all workers say they witnessed crimes or wrongdoing at their workplace, but only 3% blow the whistle to the authorities. While some portray whistleblowers as snitches and leakers, Michael McCrae says it takes courage and tenacity to speak out and stand up. Michael blew the whistle on $40 million of fraud during the Clinton administration and has become one of the world's foremost proponents for whistleblowers. His book is entitled Race, Power, and Politics, and he joins us on the line right now from Arkansas. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Peter. Thanks. Thank you for having me on your show.
Thanks for being on the program with us. What? First off, there are people who debate between the issue of leakers and whistleblowers as if there is a difference. Do you see a difference between the two? And if so, what?
Absolutely, Peter. Whistleblowing, especially in America, is a time-honored tradition that's really associated with the First Amendment of our Constitution. And so if you think about it, there can be no free press without news sources. There's no congressional oversight without government informants. I tell people that whistleblowers are the fifth estate that protect our freedom and liberty. And so because it's so central to our freedom and our democracy, I distinguish it between leakers and other illegal acts. So, for instance, let's think about the mafia. You know, Sammy the Bull Gravone was not a whistleblower. You know, he was an unindicted co-conspirator or someone who kind of cut a deal to save himself. Whistleblowers are really people that find themselves in the possession of lawful information that is concerning to them about their government or perhaps a corporation, and they go to the authorities. These are people who have something to lose, something on the line at the moment that they stand up. And so to me and to our community, that really distinguishes whistleblowers from leakers or really other types of informants.
And to drill down a little bit, not only do they have something on the line, but they personally don't have something to gain by being a whistleblower.
Generally speaking, Peter, I mean, because that's the line where you draw when you start to talk about whistleblowers in the avenue of public health and safety. I'm blowing the whistle because I see something wrong with the food supply. But the one thing that we've done is we've broadened that concept to talk about whistleblowing from the perspective of human and civil rights. So I host the Whistleblower Summit for Civil and Human Rights. And one of the distinctions that makes is that I used to work for USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture. And one of the things that I reported had dealt with discrimination. I happen to be African American. Now, technically, I could benefit from the fact that I blew the whistle on the discrimination and retaliation in my case. But generally speaking, when you find a bad culture, you'll find that, you know, you're blowing the whistle on a violation of laws. It may affect you or it may affect other people.
Well, when
and the other case is where sometimes, in the United States, we have this thing called the False Claims Act. And this was a whistleblower law that was written, that was signed by Abraham Lincoln. And what it does is it was during the Civil War where defense contractors were essentially defrauding the U.S. And so Abraham Lincoln wanted to have a program where a whistleblower could receive a reward, a bounty, a portion of the proceeds that the government would save. So, you know, if you found a company that defrauded the government of $50 million, a whistleblower could win from, you know, 10 to 20% of the money that the government recovers. So I don't want to ever say that that whistleblowers can't benefit, but most people blow the whistle. It's really not for money.
Okay. Now, you mentioned a whistleblower and a conference. There's actually one coming up on Capitol Hill in July. I believe it's July 30th, that is National Whistleblower Appreciation Day. And this is one of the largest and most prestigious whistleblower conferences. Is that correct?
That's correct. When making a long story short, Peter, you know, I grew up in Arkansas and I got a chance to go to Washington, D.C. when my governor ran for president. You know, I got to work for the White House. I blew the whistle and suffered all the retaliation. I lost my job. I lost the business interest. I lost my fiance. I almost lost my mind. And one of the things that helped me was I happened to attend a conference. Then it was known as Washington Whistleblower Week, and I was able to find a place of camaraderie, so a mutual support network. And so this was so beneficial to me because people really don't understand, but 10% of whistleblowers actually commit suicide. And it comes from the isolation and, you know, you lose, again, the financial and personal losses can be so devastating. But finding other whistleblowers really saved my life and saved my sanity. So one of the things that I do to give back is I started hosting the Whistleblower Summit for Civil and Human Rights. And we've been doing it now for about the last 7 years. And the reason that we chose July 30th is that is actually the anniversary of the very first whistleblower law that was passed by the Continental Congress in 1778.
Wow. Now, you obviously are an evangelist for this topic. You've written a book. You're leading this conference. But as you said, there was a heavy price to pay for you yourself being a whistleblower. You've come through the other side of it, but looking back at that time, just after you became a whistleblower, were there ever moments of doubt when the world seemed to be against you that you had possibly done the wrong thing?
Oh, yes, without a doubt. So, Peter, sometimes I think I've done the wrong thing even today. But I was able to kind of pick myself up, and I tell people that rock bottom was the firm foundation on which I rebuilt my life. And I found and I dedicated myself to making something positive out of the journey and the devastation that I suffered. So I think I told you a few minutes ago that one of the things that helped save me was attending the conference. The other thing that helped me was my father gave me a copy of Rick Warren's book, A Purpose-Driven Life. And so I've kind of, those two things really turned things around for me. And so now I'm a strong advocate for whistleblowers, whistleblower protections. And also, I really feel like I've really been teaching people about the power of story, how your personal testimony can be used for so much good in society. So, you know, a lot of times if you're a whistleblower, if you're a doctor, you may lose your hospital privileges. If you're an attorney, you may be disbarred. And that's very devastating for a lot of whistleblowers. You know, some people are these people can be very fragile. Some people are fragile like a flower. Some people are fragile like a bomb. And so that's one of the reasons that we bring people together to try to diffuse that situation and allow people to turn their lives to make something useful for their life. So what I started to do was I started writing about, my story and what happened to me. There was an episode when I was a member of ACORN. After I left the federal government, I wound up in a situation where I was a victim of commercial mortgage fraud. So I joined the Association of Community Organizations for Reform now, and there's a whole area of my life, and that's really the subject matter of the book. And so Race, Power, and Politics explains why people get involved in direct action organizations, why people need organizations like ACORN, and really what it means to join a grassroots, really political movement from the inside out. So that's the story of that book. And I actually have a sequel coming up a little later that will be released a little later this year called Truth, Transparency, and Accountability. And that's the inside story of what caused the fall of ACORN.
Mm. Now, we got about a minute to go, but I, since you were in a situation where you were involved in a whistleblowing situation and you were also in government, I've got to ask you right now, because of what's going on in the world today. We mentioned right in the headlines, we're talking about whistleblowers and leakers, and I'm sure you're fully aware that right now the White House is leaking like a sieve.
Yes.
What would you tell people who are working in the White House, honest, hardworking people who are working in the West Wing or working in any level of government right now, who feels something isn't right and they should do something? How would you counsel them?
Well, Peter, that's a prime example of really why whistleblowers are actually heroes. If you, statistically speaking, there's a great study at my website, www.whistleblowersummit.com, also www.acorn8.com. You can get this study, and it's the largest kind of it's the largest longitudinal analysis of whistleblowers. And what it essentially tells you is that most whistleblowers come out of government service. The second number come from nonprofit organizations, and corporations have the third highest number of whistleblowers. And the reason is this: when you work for the government, you feel like you have government employees feel a certain allegiance to the country, even beyond their job. That's what I felt. I was blessed with having a public trust. And so when I saw something wrong, look, my hometown was once ranked the worst place to live in America 2 years in a row. So when I saw people in Washington stealing, it was $40 million fraud, when I saw people stealing money from this program, to me, I saw the people that it represented. And so I felt a stronger loyalty and allegiance to my fellow citizens, which is why I blew the whistle. And, you know, the same can be true for people in nonprofit organizations. While it's not as strong as the government, but there is some correlation to taxpayers and the public benefit, the public good. And so these are the decisions that some people just have to make. I would counsel people to be very careful. There's a very high price to pay. I would advise people to look before they leap. possibly attend the Whistleblower Summit, where you can meet other lawyers and advocates and other people who have taken that journey with you. But one of the main things to remember is this. When you blow the whistle, you never blow the whistle alone. When you blow the whistle, your whole family blows the whistle with you. So it's a very heavy decision to make, and you should definitely get some counseling before you try to do it.
And one other thing they should probably do is get a copy of your book first, Race, Power, and Politics, and sort of use it as a blueprint. What's that website you mentioned? You mentioned two, whistleblowersummit.com and another one.
And www.acorn8.com. Acorn8.com. And actually, the name of the book, it's a book series. Acorn 8, Race, Power, and Politics, Memoirs of a Acorn Whistleblower is the first book. And as I said, the sequel comes out later this fall, which is Acorn 8, Truth, Transparency, and Accountability, Inside the Fall of Acorn.
Michael, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
All right. Thank you, Peter. Thank you for having me.
Michael McRae, author of Acorn 8, Race, Power, and Politics, Memoirs of an Acorn Whistleblower. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0460, and you'll find links to Michael's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. On the air on stations in Singapore, New Zealand, and America, and streaming through your computer. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Dr. John Huber about non-competitive school sports, and Stuart Nellman is in with another edition of Book Banter. We do have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Several months after Bruce Roberts died, cleaners began clearing his Sydney, North South Wales, Australian property out. According to neighbors, Roberts was a hoarder and lived in the house for 40 or 50 years, so there was a lot of trash to sort through. I'm guessing perhaps even shopping bags from long-defunct supermarkets, but I digress. But none of them expected to find a dead body rolled up in a carpet. The body was mummified, and it took a post-mortem examination to even determine the sex of the deceased, now identified as a male in his 30s or 40s, who had significant injuries before his death. Police believe Roberts hid the body in his house sometime before his own death. Really, Sherlock? Before his own death, huh? Wow. The man's identity hasn't been released pending notification of his family, and investigators are trying to determine the connection between the two men. Police haven't formally determined the cause of death and say that Roberts isn't a suspect at this stage. Roberts, as usual, has nothing to say. That's because he's dead. Yeah. Frustration with the cable company boiled over in Ridgewood, New Jersey on May 7th when a dispute between the Optimum employee and a woman left the cable worker stranded on high. While the employee was in an elevated bucket working on lines, a 59-year-old woman turned off the truck and took utility property before walking away, making it impossible for the worker to lower the bucket. Ridgewood police charged the woman with harassment, false imprisonment, disorderly conduct, and criminal trespass. Well, if she's sent to jail, I hope they take away her television privileges. And 19-year-old Diamond Ellis was charged with stabbing and killing her roommate, 25-year-old Jace Trevon Ernst, in North Las Vegas, Nevada, after a May 4th argument. According to North Las Vegas police, Ellis became upset after Ernst repeatedly talked while she tried to watch a TV show, telling him to shut up. When he responded with an expletive, she went to the kitchen for a knife. Police said Ellis had threatened Ernst with a knife about 10 times in the last couple of months, but he had been able in the past to get the knife away from her. Ellis told an officer that she has anger problems and she just got extremely upset tonight. Wow. What the hell was she watching on television? The series Snapped? Again, for this one in jail, no TV. Moving right along, as it negotiated a roundabout in Paisley, Renfrewshire, Scotland, a dump truck filled with manure lost its balance on May 21st and tipped over, spilling its load onto a Peugeot 208 with the driver inside. A witness said he couldn't believe anyone got out alive, but the male driver was able to crawl through the pile of excrement and was unhurt, if not stinky. The car, however, was crushed, according to a Police Scotland spokesman. You know, in the future, if anyone turns to that driver and says, "I'm having the crappiest day," he's going to snap. Yeah. A 22-year-old Arizona man was arrested after he told guests at a Disney resort that there was an active shooter so he could record their reactions and post it to YouTube. Dillion Birch was highly intoxicated, and that's an important fact because if he wasn't highly intoxicated, he would have clearly been the idiot of the day. But I digress. Anyway, Dillion Birch was highly intoxicated and, after midnight, was running up to guests at Disney's Contemporary Resort and telling them that they had to evacuate because of the shooter. Birch then told the police he was joking and wanted to see what their reactions were for a school project. The incident caused a significant disturbance and the resort had to go on lockdown. Deputies found Birch hiding in some bushes and arrested him. He was taken to the Orange County Jail on disturbance of the peace and disorderly intoxication charges. Gee, do you think he might get an incomplete on his school project? Here's hoping. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Lyons, New York resident 53-year-old Jesse Graham must have been surprised when deputies of the Wayne County Sheriff's Department appeared at his door on May 11th. Graham, a fugitive wanted by the Mooresville, North Carolina Police Department, had apparently accidentally dialed 911, summoning the deputies himself. Graham was charged with being a fugitive from justice and possession of marijuana, and he awaits extradition to North Carolina. You know, sometimes when you butt dial, you just make an ass of yourself. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? According to a survey in the UK, 57% of children at primary school say their sports day is non-competitive. So the question has to be asked, is that really a good idea for the kids? Luckily, we have someone to ask that question of. Clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber is back on the program. He's the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, which is a nonprofit organization. And John joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, John.
Hello, Peter. How are you doing today?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. Full disclosure, you know, I live in a Commonwealth country. I live here in Canada. I am a monarchist. I love Britain. I've got nothing but nice things to say about Britain. But every once in a while, we have stories that come up and on our show that prove that Britain really does put the nanny in nanny state.
Oh, yeah.
And I think this is one of them.
Well, it's unfortunate. We've already got some school districts on the East Coast and a couple, well, actually fewer on the East Coast, but more on the West Coast that have already tried to implement this. And the non-competitive sports is a crazy thing. I mean, I totally understand the idea. You know, you don't want kids to hold grudges against other kids and things like that. But one of the things that we found out here doing the research is when you do this, kids understand that the team that gets more goals is actually the winner. So what happens, they do that at a little age, 5 or 6 years old, they understand this. So when an adult, a teacher, says that nobody won and everybody gets the same trophy, the first thing you're teaching these kids is that adults lie and you can't trust them. And that is extremely problematic for the long-term development of those kids right off the bat.
The other thing, too, I remember from my days in school is if I were to look back at what I got out of schooling, and I'm talking primary school and the early parts of high school, the greatest thing I got out of that was learning how to deal with other people. You are preparing children for the life they have outside of school or beyond school, and that's much more than academic. And the world is a competitive place.
It is extremely competitive, and you are not doing a service to these kids by not teaching them how to deal with failure. Because in the real world, if you get, how many more failures do you have before you have a success? If you play Major League Baseball, if you're only successful 30% of the time, you end up in the Hall of Fame. So you've got to deal with 70% failure to make it to the Hall of Fame, and those are the stars. So everybody else is doing much worse than that.
Well, you know, we could.
That is.
We could solve.
Well, that's the way life is.
We could solve that problem with baseball, by the way, if Major League just played T-ball.
Yeah, but, you know, I just don't think somebody's grandpa up there putting that ball on that thing. I mean, that'd take a while, and you get walkers in the way and everything else. So, yeah.
As somebody who is a psychologist, do you ever pause to when you hear stories like this, do you ever pause to think, if you could have the opportunity to talk to the people who implement these ideas, do you ever question what school was like for them?
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that. I'm usually there as an advocate for the kids. I could care less what that person's childhood was like. I want to be there to help and make our kids' world better. So you've got an adult who's already in a position of power who's making these things. You know, if they want to come to work with me on their own time, then we can go talk about the development and how they process things in their life and what they're upset about and how they're taking power and control from other people to fill in goals and problems that they had growing up. I'm an advocate for people who are being harmed right now. And it's kind of bizarre because nobody in this situation has me as their therapist. So I'm out there as my nonprofit being the let's do what's right for the public in general. And that's the kind of position I take it. And it's kind of funny. It's like people when they invite me to their dinner parties and my wife and I, she really thinks it's funny. In fact, I'll have to tell you about something else that happened recently, but we go to parties and people find out I'm a psychologist and they immediately start telling me all their stories about, oh, this is what's going on with my kid, and this is what, you know, or they give me the question, oh, you're analyzing me now, right? What do you know about me? And my answer is, I get paid to do that. You know, I'm here relaxing. I'm a human being the rest of the time. And so I now have a shirt that says, go ahead, keep talking, I'm diagnosing you. And I've got a couple of those. And I just got them like within the last 2 weeks. It's hilarious. But it's funny because my wife loves them and other people have come up to me and they start, oh, really? What am I, you know, what's happening now? I'm like, this is satire because I don't diagnose you unless I've got permission to do it. I mean, there's ethics involved and it's my livelihood. I mean, that's just the bottom line.
I think I'm going to send you a T-shirt that says, well, that's interesting with that in capital. Just to see what people say when they see the T-shirt.
Awesome.
Now,
but when we talk about competitive sports, though, I mean, they're a resemblance to what we used to do. I mean, if you think back to lacrosse, for example, I mean, the losing side, the team got beheaded, and that kept the two tribes from going and slaughtering each other. You know, so these land acquisition games, whether it's football, baseball, soccer, they represent part of human nature of warring tribes fighting together. And one of the reasons why we get so excited when our hockey team is winning we feel a dominance over the other team and that province where they're at. And it goes back to what man has done since the beginning of time, try to expand and take control of power over land and other people. And it's symbolic, but it's also very healthy. And we satisfy lots of needs that way. You take away that competitiveness, and you're taking away part of what is in us genetically and evolutionarily. So it's problematic at the very best.
One of the other things that I found disturbing about this survey was the fact that, as I said, 57% of parents with children at primary school say their sports day is non-competitive. 86% of those responders did not approve necessarily of that trait. So we have the parents to a large percentage not agreeing with this as far as their own kids' schools are concerned.
Well, and that's interesting you say that, because what's happening is academia has been taken over by this let's treat everybody exactly the same way. And if we go back and think of who made that famous, was Martin Luther King, when he said, treat everybody the same with respect to their differences. Everybody forgets that last sentence that he put in there, because everybody has different abilities, and we need to focus in and let people use their strength to not only help themselves, but when they do that, they help the rest of the world as well. But when we repress those other abilities, we actually do damage to the human psyche in general.
Do you see this as a swinging pendulum where you will have more situations of this happening as time goes on, but somewhere down the road, the pendulum will swing back?
I want to believe the pendulum has reached its apex and it's starting to come back the other way. And maybe I'm a little naive right now, but you know, over the past 2 or 3 years, I've seen a lot of things start kind of coming to a head and reversing themselves subtly. So I'm optimistic. I think we need to be somewhere between the two extremes we've been. And one of the things that's got to do that is free expression and the ability to stop and listen to what people have opposing voices and listen to what they actually say instead of immediately jumping to you're evil because you don't believe in what I believe. And I think that's starting to happen finally.
Well, let's hope, because again, my biggest fear is if you have a nanny state to a certain degree and everyone complies with that idea and it works out and you live in a non-competitive world or a non-competitive part of the world, no matter what goes wrong, if you all come out and sing Kumbaya or rally around a tree with no presence like all the Who's in Whoville, you will be crushed by the rest of the world.
Exactly. You will be. And it may come from inside, too. When everything becomes gray, I mean, nothing gets whitewashed. It all becomes gray because nobody works quite as hard as they would otherwise. And everything becomes mediocrity. And the bright colors go away. The dull colors become a little bit duller. And you die on the inside a little bit, just like in Whoville. I think you're right. That's a perfect example.
John, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Peter. It is always a pleasure to be a guest on your show. You do a great job, and I'm glad to be part of it.
Dr. John Huber, chairman for Mainstream Mental Health. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0460, and you'll find links to John's site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Dorigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Driving a commercial truck can be a tough way to make a living. Truckers often have to begin work before dawn and drive in stressful situations with heavy loads. Unfortunately, it just got tougher. A truck driver in Texas has been held responsible for a deadly crash, even though it was caused by a driver coming at him who lost control of his vehicle and swerved across the center line into his truck. It was a tragic crash. One person died, and another is now a quadriplegic. However, the trucker was driving under the speed limit and was in his own lane. Despite that, a jury has told his company to pay a verdict of $89.6 million. Let's be fair, if the trucker had broken any traffic laws, some kind of verdict against him would be understandable.
But this trucker didn't cause the crash, and unfortunately, it appears that the jury was looking more at who had the deep pockets than who was actually responsible. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here he is once again, the gainfully employed Stuart Nauman. Hello, Stu.
Hey, Peter. Hey, get a job. Sha-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. Thought I'd sing that.
Are you done?
Yes.
Okay.
Mercifully.
Oh, wow.
Well, once in a while, I like to bring the song, if it's relevant to the theme of the book I'm about to review, and it does on this edition of Book Banter. It's a book called Hire Me If You Can, which was not a Steven Spielberg movie that starred Tom Hanks and Leonardo DiCaprio. No. But these days, Peter, you know, a resume with a long list of previous jobs can have a stigma attached to it, meaning one's inability to hold on to a job for an extended period of time, and would not bode well for any future employer, let alone potential employee. Now, Montreal writer Bram Eisenthal has been through the employment ringer, and throughout his quest for finding a meaningful, satisfying career, he has done a whole litany of jobs, from stockroom boy, department store clerk, journalist, electronics firm salesman, freelance magazine writer, movie unit publicist, organizational communications consultant, newspaper publisher slash editor, and his current line of work, which is a security guard. But throughout his 61 years, Bram has never let up this quest, nor his need to work. And through his polished writing skills, he has told his story about his long road towards meaningful employment by his first published book, an entertaining memoir called Hire Me If You Can. Now, Bram is the son of Holocaust survivors, and he was instilled with this need to work ethic from his father, Mike. And when he was barely in his teens, Eisenthal got his first taste of working for a living when he was hired as a busboy in a resort in Laurentian's Mountains area of Montreal, like straight out of the pages of Mordecai Richler's book, The Apprenticeship of Dirty Kravitz. But although not the keenest of students, Eisenthal found his calling in the world of journalism and got his feet wet, writing for a number of publications, first student publications, weekly newspapers, and even the legendary American horror sci-fi magazine Fangoria, which is a very it ranks up there with famous monsters of filmland, if you ask me. But 25 years ago, he was hired as a unit publicist for a film that was about to be shot in Montreal called Rainbow. And this proves to be the book's longest and most absorbing chapter, which sort of reads like a juicy tell-all memoir, because Eisenthal uses his penchant for behind-the-scenes details to provide all the memorable moments, tensions, egos, brushes with celebrity, and bend-over-backwards tasks that he had to endure as a unit publicist. And then there's my other favorite chapter, which I call the saga of the giant colon. Because, yeah,
do we really want to know about that on a family radio program?
Well, it's not as bad as you think, Peter.
Okay.
And it's not a Godzilla-type movie. No.
Okay, so it's not up there with someone who recently passed away, Philip Roth's The Breast?
No. No, yeah. Far from that.
Because I read, by the way, The Breast when I was about 14, 15 years old, and that book scarred me for life. That's all I'm going to say. It's a great book, but wow, when you read, and it's only a novella, but when you read through that thing, it's like, whoa, that's way too deep for my little brain to comprehend at this age. But anyway.
Maybe that's something I should check out. I'll go to the secondhand bookstore and see if they can have. I can get myself a copy of that.
Yes. Anyway, I put you off track. Go ahead. Continue with. Brain.
Oh well, it's okay. from breast to his giant colon.
Got you away from the colon. There you go.
Yeah. Well, what I meant about the saga of the giant colon is because at one time, Bram was hired as the national manager of exhibits by the Colorectal Cancer Association of Canada. About 10 years ago, and his chief responsibility was to coordinate, organize, and manage what they would call the giant colon tour. Basically, he would oversee the construction and display of a 40-foot-long reproduction of a human colon where visitors, which would be displayed in major shopping malls, and visitors for free were able to explore inside the colon and find up close and personal of how and what causes colorectal cancer.
I bet no one shook his hand at conferences.
Oh, there was plenty of Purell, I bet you. I bet you there's plenty of Purell.
Oh, I don't think there could be enough.
Well, you know, Eisenthal somehow managed to develop a thick skin and nerves of steel to oversee this task and the pitfalls and headaches that went with it to its successful conclusion, and a task that would have shattered the resolve of any mere mortal who had to, you know, put up any other big human body part in a shopping mall, I guess. But, you know, what makes Hire Me If You Can such an appealing book is that whatever Eisenthal went through and endured throughout his quest for meaningful employment, the reader can easily identify with his situations and dilemmas because, for most part, we've all went through such similar scenarios. And, you know, his brash, unabashed prose gives off a tone that sometimes we wish we could take up without the fear of recrimination. It makes us not only empathize with him, but want to read even more about his exploits towards finding that career-defining job, which is why I found this book such an interesting page-turner. So, thanks to this book, Hire Me If You Can, Bram Weisenthal can now add two more positions to his impressive resume. Published author and storyteller, and a heck of a good one for the latter.
There isn't a giant colon on the cover, is there?
No.
Okay.
There is not. It will not. This will not scare potential readers.
Okay. So the book is
called Hire Me If You Can by Bram Weisenthal. It's published by Southern Owl Publications, and it's $16 in trade paperback.
And dare I ask, could you find another book in this genre?
Well, not about giant human body parts, Peter. So let's be grateful about that. But books about finding jobs and about employment. There's also the classic "What Color Is Your Parachute" by Richard Nelson Bowles, which is like the Bible for job hunters. And there's two books by investigative journalist Barbara Ehrenreich that I highly recommend. One called Nickel and Dimed, about she went undercover and what it was like to work in such jobs like as being a hotel chambermaid in a chain hotel and working for Walmart. And also Bait and Switch, about what she called the white collar unemployed, about what people had to go through seminars and job interviews and, you know, way out type of methods to get a job in the white collar world.
Hmm. So again, this week's book is
called Hire Me If You Can by Bram Weisenthal. It's published by Southern Owl Publications, and it's $16.
And if someone wants to hire you, where can they find you?
Well, you won't find me putting up 40-foot giant colons, but you'll find me in the pages of the Montreal Times every Saturday, or online every week, www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
And you're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a bit. We'll get to that in a moment. But I got a few more Stuff File news stories that I want to share with you right here, right now. A Middletown, Connecticut woman was upset over her Wendy's order and hit the cashier with a burger. Middletown police responded to the Wendy's. The assistant manager told police a woman was upset about a burger order. The woman, Holly Bartolotta, began to yell and swear and then threw her burger at the cashier. Police say Bartolotta also hit another customer during the incident. Bartolotta told police that she was upset about the employees getting the order wrong and more upset about how they handled the situation. She admitted to throwing the burger as well as yelling, swearing, and bumping into another customer. Bartolotta was issued a misdemeanor summons for breach of peace and will be in court on June 15th. You know, this is a dangerous woman. I mean, if she were at any other burger joint, this would be harmless. But as you know, Wendy's burgers are square, not round. They have corners. You can take an eye out with one of those things. And depending on how well it's cooked, that could be like a ninja throwing star. Anyway, a man arrested for DUI ended up with an arson complaint added to it while he was being booked. Sapulpa police in Oklahoma say that shortly after 1 a.m., an officer pulled a man over after seeing a pickup fail to stop at a stop sign. The officer says the driver, 37-year-old Michael Sanchez, was slurring his speech and had bloodshot, watery eyes. The officer says he could also smell alcohol on his breath. Sanchez was given a field sobriety test, which, needless to say, he failed, and was placed under arrest. Police say that while Sanchez was in the booking area at the Sapulpa Police Department, he lit his booking paperwork on fire. Officers said that this is the first time Sanchez has been arrested for either DUI or arson. Well, beginner's luck, I guess. Hey, you can't arrest me if there's no booking paperwork, right? Am I right? Can I get a high five?
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
This is an important self-serving promotional bulletin. My book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, is still available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. Order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. All links are on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So, buy the book. What are you waiting for? This has been an important self-serving promotional bulletin.
I love you. Now, back to our show.
25-year-old Sidney Bouvier Gilstrap Portley. Yes, that's his full name. Sidney Bouvier Gilstrap Portley. He was arrested on May 11th in Dallas after scamming his way into two Dallas high schools in an apparent effort to relive his basketball career. Gilstrap Portley was charged with posing as a 17-year-old and a Hurricane Harvey evacuee so that he could play high school basketball. As Dallas schools welcomed students displaced by the hurricane, Gilstrap Portley first enrolled at Skyline High School and then at Hillcrest High School, where he was a star on the team and dated a 14-year-old girl. In fact, high school coaches voted him Offensive Player of the Year. The Dallas Morning News reported that a former coach spotted him at a tournament and alerted Hillcrest's coaches that he had graduated, quote, a time ago. 25 years old, pretending to be 17, and dating a 14-year-old. Wow. He really is the Offensive Player of the Year, isn't he? Well, boys and girls, it's now the moment you've all been waiting for. I know you've been patient, but it's here. We're near the end of the show, which means it's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A homeowner in Mulberry, Florida, pulled into his driveway and saw a stranger leaving his house with his hands full of stolen items. According to the Polk County Sheriff's Office, Jason Thomas, and Jason spells his name with an E on the end of it, so I guess maybe it's Jason, or Jasone, or just plain weird. Anyway, Jason Thomas, or whatever he calls himself, who already had a warrant out for his arrest on violation of probation charges, dropped the items he was trying to steal, including speakers, mail, and Old Spice deodorant, when the homeowner yelled, "What the hell are you doing?" Thomas also dropped his personal items, including clothes, a charger cord, and a letter with his name on it, spelled Jason, or Jasoni, or whatever the hell it is. He was caught about an hour later. Well, I bet his antiperspirant isn't working now. I mean, why would you break into someone's house and steal their deodorant, and when caught fleeing, drop everything, including personal items? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0460. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0460. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of... Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.